call the Senate Labor and Commerce Joint Committee meeting with House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. It's February 24th, 1992, 3:38 p.m. We're in the Belts Room. Present at the moment are Senators Pierce and Kraft, also Representatives Finkelstein and Ivan. We have before us today Senate Bill 205, also House Bill 219, relating to the Nonprofit Code Revision and the Religious Corporation Revision. Because we're doing an overview of the bill today and neither committee expects to move it, we will go ahead and start even though we don't have a quorum of either committee. We have Mr. John Abbott, Chair of the Code Revision Commission, will be making the presentation. Mr. Abbott, please have a seat. We're not on teleconference, so you don't have to miss us a little.
Okay.
Mark Tom.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Tell us what you bring us.
And Mr. Chairman, and members of the Joint Senate House Labor Commerce Committees. My name is John Abbott. I'm the Chairman of the Alaska Code Revision Commission. And for those of you that are unfamiliar with our secret society, we were created in 1976 by the then legislative body, which in its wisdom felt the state should have, like other states, a permanent commission, which had as its mandate taking inquiries, requests for wholesale revision of statutes from executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. And since 1976, that's precisely what we have done. We have eight commissioners on the Code Revision Commission, including Senator Rohde and Representative Taylor, representing the legislative branch of government, Judge Tom Stewart, retired, representing the Alaska court system, Mary Hughes, who represents the Alaska Bar Association and is appointed by the Alaska Bar Association, Carolyn Jones, who represents the executive branch of government, the Attorney General's office, and three public members that are appointed by the Legislative Council, including myself, Eric Leroy, an attorney in private practice in Anchorage, and Dick Madsen, an attorney in private practice in Fairbanks. Over the past few years, we have had occasion to present to the legislature such bills as the Exemptions Act under Title IX, the Recording Act, which was a wholesale revision of recording statutes for the state of Alaska, set forth the whole procedure for that, and 1006, which is that portion of the Title X Corporations Code dealing with for-profit corporations, which leads me into background on our Title X revision. In 1980, the Corporation Code was selected as an item for consideration by the Code Revision Commission based on the fact that the then existing Title X had been based on the 5253 Model Act adopted from Oregon by the state of Alaska in 1959 as part of its creation of a system of state laws. With modest exceptions, it hadn't been changed since 1959. The first portion of our work dealt with just revision of the for-profit section. Simultaneously, and after that time, we also dealt with revisions to the Nonprofit Corporation Code, the Cooperative Corporation Code, and had made a decision back in the early 80s to stay away from the Religious Corporation Code since it's a very controversial subject. Why do we need a bill? We need a bill because there have been virtually no changes to either the Nonprofit Corporation Code or the Religious Corporation Code since they were adopted from the Model Acts in 52 and 53. And a great deal has happened since that time, not only in the state of Alaska, but in the development of corporate law throughout the United States. Why do we need a joint bill? The Code Commission conducted a 6.5-hour bloodbath public hearing, teleconference, in 1983, in which I think every religious group in the state came out en masse and challenged us because of what we had done to their corporations or what we proposed to do to their corporations. Unbeknownst to us, since no records were kept at that time, a majority of the religious corporations had incorporated under the secular nonprofit corporation chapter, 1020. The reason that they had done so was because chapter 40 did not provide a home for them amenable to their church doctrine and their needs, and I'll explain that in just a minute. The upshot was that in order to do any kind of a revision on the secular nonprofit code section, we were forced to deal with the religious corporation code section, since we today have something like 540, 550 religious corporations that are incorporated under Section 1020, the secular nonprofit code section, because they can't find a home under 1040. The problem that we had, that we discovered, was that 1040, the religious corporation section, was adopted again from the Model Act, and it was based upon not just the concepts of a nonprofit corporation, but specifically along the lines of the concepts for the Catholic Church, Church of the Latter-day Saint, certain Orthodox Jewish groups, certain other Orthodox religions such as Greek and Russian Orthodox. It provided what it was known as the corporate soul model. The corporate soul is a concept under church doctrine, canon law, which provides that a person is designated, whether it be a bishop, an archbishop, or whatever, that person personally is vested in title with all of the assets of the religious organization. And the Title 40, or Chapter 40, only provides for that type of a religious corporation. As a consequence, those corporations that wanted to have the church properties owned by a membership group or owned by a board of trustees or board of elders could not, in fact, incorporate under Chapter 40. Only thing that was left was the secular nonprofit section, hence the fact that we have so many of the non-corporate soul religious corporations now incorporated under 1020. That's why we have a double bill. It is necessary to create a new home for all of the religious groups amenable to their church doctrines, so that they can be moved out of the present Section 1020, so that a new Section 1021, a secular nonprofit act, can be created, adopted by the legislature, if it so chooses, which will not impact the religious corporations. So what we've done is created a double bill, so to speak. If you want to do something with nonprofit corporations, you must contemporaneously do something with religious corporations by providing them with a new home. The policy considerations that have gone into the creation of the new religious corporation code, which I'll refer to as the ARRC, are fairly straightforward. It continues a hands-off policy commensurate with the First Amendment rights and exemptions under the U.S. Constitution for religious organizations. It provides specific guidance for those corporations so that laypersons will know how to create their corporations and know what to do once you become a corporation. Most importantly, it provides for three different types of corporate form, all in the same bill, with the same responsibilities. It continues in existence the corporate soul, which under existing law is Chapter 40. It eases some of the requirements under Chapter 40, which are more stringent, including reporting requirements, than those found in the nonprofit section that presently affect churches. So those corporations that are presently existing under Chapter 40 should feel that they're getting, and there's an added incentive for them to be relocated into 1041, so to speak. Even-handed treatment for all the corporations. Secondly, we create a trustee-type corporation which recognizes the needs of certain churches to have an organization which is operated by the trustees and in which the trustees make decisions about the acquisition, sale of assets, entering into contracts, all the things that corporations do. The third type of corporation that's recognized is the membership corporation, where you have membership. The Congregational Church is an example of that, where your members actually approve all of the expenditures, major expenditures, budgets, so on and so forth, for the church itself. And again, the corporation owns the property, but it's guided by the membership. Again, keep in mind, with your corporate soul, you have no members, you have no board. You have a single individual who makes policy for all major financial decisions on behalf of the corporation. And again, that's not acceptable to most. Now, Some of the salient features of the ARCC include the fact that it continues a hands-off policy. In other words, there's no attempt in the bill to try and regulate, restrict, or otherwise make it more difficult for the religious group to operate as a corporation, with one minor exception, which I'll point out in a minute. It promotes the concept of freedom of religion under the U.S. Constitution. It continues, for the most part, existing Alaska law. The difference being that it puts the new religious corporations into their own home rather than keeping them in a secular nonprofit code chapter where they don't belong. It will avoid litigation in the long run because virtually everything is spelled out. What the Code Commission refers to as the cookbook. A layperson can pick it up, can go through it in a very organized, through a very organized index, and find out exactly everything you need to know about it. Under current law, you need to not only look throughout the chapters 20 and 40 respectively to determine what your rights, obligations, and duties are, but you also have to look in other sections of the for-profit section, which are incorporated by reference, which means that it's extremely difficult for a non-lawyer to sit down and determine what's required of the corporation. The bill spells virtually everything out, from incorporation to voting, how you vote, how you select your board, how you create your memberships, how you dissolve, how you merge or consolidate. Virtually everything that the religious corporation would want to do is spelled out in detail in the bill itself. In addition to that, the commentary on the bill is fairly extensive, which in the case of the ARC, the ARCC, is important because the ARCC is really pretty much created out of whole cloth. By that, I mean that there was no other state that had this type of a comprehensive religious corporation section that recognized all of the specific types of religious doctrinal needs, as is done in this in Senate Bill 205. We provided very easy transition forms so that these forms can either be mailed out or they can be picked up at the Division of Corporations, or presumably they could even be mailed out by the Commissioner of Commerce or whatever funding source was available. There are basically three forms which the Commission has provided which allow for the easy transition from Title 20, 21 to 41, or from 41 to 21, and then a third form which directs its attention to foreign corporations that may want to do business in either one of those two nonprofit forms. So in terms of causing any disruption of the religious corporation, that should be absolutely minimal. It requires very simple information in the form to fill out, send it in. I assume that there will be a fee from the commissioner's office of some sort for the handling of the paperwork, but by and large it's going to be an extremely easy transition. And again, the hope is to get all of the religious corporations out of the nonprofit secular corporation chapter and into the religious sector. This bill tracks 1006, which is the for-profit section. Wherever applicable, the same provisions in 1006 also appear in the ARCC, so that there's compatibility between the different things. The code itself provides for an extensive definition section so that it's easy for somebody without legal training to look in the definition section and figure out exactly what the language means. Wherever there's reference to a different section in some portion of the bill, that's cross-referenced, so the reader will know to look in a different section of the bill by number so that you can find out what additional information is required or what additional definition is provided as to that particular section that you're dealing with. The reporting requirements are minimum. They're pretty much, they pretty much follow reporting requirements for existing law. There's nothing that's onerous in terms of any of the paperwork. When reporting requirements are extracted from a religious corporation, they're coupled with the filing of the biennial report, so that you use one piece of paper to satisfy two purposes. One is to meet the informational needs of the Division of Corporations. The other is to provide minimum financial information at the same time on the same form. So there should be little or no impact on the religious corporation. I made reference earlier to a new provision in there that is not found in existing law and will impose a new obligation, if you will, on the churches. Under existing law, there's no specific reference to the concept of charitable trusts. We propose to codify that in this bill. The concept of the charitable trust is a common law concept, would in all likelihood be imposed by a court if the question were to come before the court. What we've done is to try and codify what would probably be the result anyway. The charitable trust works in two different ways. If there is an unsolicited, unspecific bequest or donation made to a religious organization, there is by law a reasonable expectation that the general purposes of the religious group, whatever they are, will be furthered in using that contribution or donation. That might just be a tithe or an offering that's made, and the expectation of the parishioner would be that that money would go to further church purposes rather than to send somebody on the board of elders to a trip to Hawaii for 3 months. Okay. The second part of the charitable trust concept is a specific bequest. If I go to the church elders and tell them I really would like to have a pew dedicated to my Aunt Minnie, and I'm willing to pay $10,000 to get that accomplished, then I have a reasonable expectation that Aunt Minnie will get her pew dedicated. And if she doesn't, I will have a cause of action under the new code for breach of that charitable trust condition. Other than that, we're talking in terms of codification of general concepts of common law, which would be applied by a court anyway. This short-circuits the process of arguing the applicability of charitable trust concepts by putting it in the statute itself. We believe that this will have a minimum impact on the religious corporations. It will assist them in getting into a type of corporation code section where they ought to be or should have been in the first place. It will clarify the law substantially, spell out what their rights and obligations and duties are. We believe it will have a minimum or non-existent impact upon the division of corporations. And I say that because even though there will be a minimum financial reporting requirement for the ARCC corporations, that will be included in its biennial report anyway, which is a piece of paper that they already have to shuffle every 2 years. We think it's a good bill. We think it's the logical progression from the enactment of 1006, the For-Profit Corporation Code, and we think that it will allow us to do something significant with the Non-Profit Secular Corporation Code, which I'll now turn my attention to.
If we could just take a moment, are there
sure.
any questions about the religious code?
Okay.
Representative Finkelsteins.
The charitable trust concept you're talking about, is that in the nonprofit code as well?
Yes.
Okay, and is it, you're pointing out as significant because it's a new provision.
It's not presently found in Chapter 40 of Title 10.
Is it somehow been ruled by the courts to be sort of inherent in the law, or is it?
It's a common law doctrine. And what it means is that if I give you certain funds, you hold yourself out to be a charitable organization, and I give you certain funds.
I understand the concept, but has it been applied in any court cases to apply to any of these religious entities?
I'm not sure that it has. I'm certainly not familiar with any cases in which it's been applied, although I wouldn't be surprised to find out that there is use of such a doctrine. It's not a novel doctrine. It's been around for probably 500 or 600 years, the concept of impressing a charitable trust on funds. And it's used outside of religious corporation codes quite frequently in other civil matters. And what it is, it's just a court saying we're going to characterize certain funds as being of a certain nature which can't be used for other than a singular purpose. And virtually that's what impressing a trust will do as far as funds are concerned.
Does the IRS look at a statute that a particular state has and then give a blanket if you can get a nonprofit license under Alaska statute, you have automatic nonprofit status under the tax codes, or is it an individual thing that you have to apply? the licensee, that he has to apply separately for status.
You mean separately for what?
For tax purposes. Does each
what happens?
Probation holder have to apply separately to the IRS for?
Yes.
Okay.
How that works is that in order to receive nonprofit tax treatment under Section 501c3 of the Internal Revenue Code, it's necessary for you to meet certain specific requirements, including requirements on non-accumulation of excess capital surplus, distribution not being made to any of the members or shareholders, distribution being made to a similar type of nonprofit corporation upon dissolution, this sort of thing. All of those provisions that are presently required by 501c3 are incorporated verbatim into the section dealing with the Articles of Incorporation. Now, with the understanding that it's often the case that you're required to send into Internal Revenue Service a second piece of paper, which they say, if it's not specifically in your articles, they want to see a second piece of paper, notwithstanding the fact that by operation of law, all of those provisions are deemed to be incorporated in your article of incorporation. In other words, as a condition of your receiving the charter as a charitable religious organization, you agree to abide by all of those terms that are in the statute. Sometimes they want you to actually put it physically in your articles in addition to that operation of law. So it again depends on who you deal with at the Internal Revenue Service. But yes, it's a two-step process. You must qualify under state law, and then you must qualify under the Internal Revenue Code.
Any other questions? Great.
Thank you.
Continue.
Proceeding on to the ANCC. The Nonprofit Corporation Code, the secular portion, which is presently Section 1020 of Title 10. Suffers from the same disabilities that the Religious Corporation Code does in different respects. First, it was taken again from the 53 Act, and there have been no significant amendments since 1959 to that particular act. It also is very, very poorly organized, so that it's extremely difficult for somebody to sit down and look at it and find out what the obligations are. The policy considerations that have gone into the drafting of the ANCC are several. One, it tends to distinguish between two basic types of corporations, which both find presence in the nonprofit sector. One being a mutual benefit corporation, that would be something like the Chamber of Commerce, and a public benefit corporation, and that would be something like United Way. The difference between the two is that there's a modicum of control with mutual benefit corporations in that you have active participation by the members, and there's greater accountability over the use or distribution of the funds that are collected from donations. When you make a contribution to United Way, for example, you may be able to generally state that you'd like the money to go to a specific organization, but that's the extent to which you can determine how that money is going to be used, whether it goes to administrative expense, 99% administrative expense, whether it goes to, pay a lot of high salaries, whatever it goes for, you have absolutely no control over that. As a consequence, the bill distinguishes between treatment for public benefit corporations, imposing greater burdens on them, from mutual benefit corporations, which have more of a membership-type policing capability than public benefit corporations do by virtue of the way that they're structured. And if you have something like Chamber of Commerce and the membership is unhappy with the way things are being done, they'll probably disband or create a new organization or change the board of directors or do something. You can't do that with United Way because you have no mechanism for doing so. There's also greater accountability on what the Chamber of Commerce does with its fund because you can indicate preferences for how the money is actually spent. So the ANCC recognizes the different nature of those two types of nonprofit corporations and gives them separate treatment accordingly. The same cookbook approach is used in the nonprofit secular corporation section so that a lay person can pick the section up, look at it, know exactly and precisely what to put in the Articles of Incorporation, can see optional provisions that can be put in there if so desired, and it spells out to the extent possible in lay terms all of the things that you do when you're a corporation, from voting to electing directors to quorum requirements to dissolution, involuntary or voluntary, what your rights are if you seek court intervention, you know, what you have to file specifically with the commissioner of the commissioner's department. In other words, everything is spelled out in there, including, again, an extensive definition section so that you can define those terms and the layperson can identify what it is that that particular word means within the context of the provision. Plus, the same cross-referencing to different sections so that when you look at one section, if there's something else that bears upon that particular section, its definition or implementation, you immediately know where to go to look for the second part for the additional information. While we've attempted to create a minimum of regulatory oversight, in fact, this will change the way nonprofit corporations presently do business. It is going to provide that if you attempt to avoid the more stringent requirements for a public benefit corporation, for example, that the court will impose a charitable trust on certain funds. So there's no benefit to seeking a public benefit corporation or a mutual benefit corporation because you feel that you're going to escape some of the obligations called for in the bill. Secondly, the fiscal requirements are not extensive. Again, they call for providing certain information to be filed on the same piece of paper that you use when you file your biennial report. We're talking about information to be provided once every 2 years by the religious corporation. There are provisions in the bill which make it necessary upon request for you to provide information to your members, if you have members, or you to the membership, if you have a membership type nonprofit corporation, so that people will know what it is that you're doing. There are no unreasonable requests, there are no expensive audit requirements, there are certain provisions which exempt small corporations, those being corporations with fewer than 100 members or with an annual gross contribution of less than $10,000, from any type of reporting requirements, other than to just give general information to the members if they see fit. So it will not have an impact on those. For larger corporations with more than 500, it calls for making known to them and also provides for alternative methods that the corporation can choose to notify the general membership as to what the corporation is generally doing with the money. It provides in spelled out form for how a derivative shareholder action can be brought. It specifies who can bring an action for an alleged grievance by a member or somebody that's affected, you know, a creditor or another person that's affected by something that the corporation does. For example, an illegal distribution that renders the corporation insolvent. It provides for the jurisdiction of the Superior Court. It provides for the appointment of either a receiver or a trustee as appropriate by the Superior Court. It allows the commissioner to intervene or the director of corporations to intervene at his option. All the provisions in here are discretionary, so that if the commissioner or his designee wishes to take some action against a corporation, the statute provides the authority for doing so, including the use of interrogatories to obtain information from a corporation. Again, that's optional. The commissioner can take that action or not as he or she sees fit. This bill, too, has extensive commentary, although it's less critical in terms of the nonprofit corporation code because it's based largely on existing Alaska law and the laws of the state of New York, California, and Washington, so that there's a greater amount of knowledge, massive knowledge out there, if you will, and court interpretations of how you should treat various of the sections. Nevertheless, the commentary does provide the source of the statutory provision, cases that are where the decisions have been codified in the statute itself, and gives you a great deal of assistance which should cut down on litigation, or on the need for litigation, because pretty much everything is going to be spelled out. The court can look at it, and it'll be fairly clear. This is what the legislature intended. So, just in closing, I would like to say that there are some further materials that are available. If you want to be inundated with more paper, there's probably 3 or 4 more inches that the commission would be delighted to provide you with. That will not sit well with staff, I'm sure. I'm also available to work with your staff, to answer any questions that they have, to participate in workup sessions given a reasonable amount of advance notice, to provide you with additional information. And I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you may have at this time.
Thank you very, very much. Questions right now? Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you. Back on the differentiation between these two types of charitable entities, can you give us any other examples besides United Way? I have a hard time. Most of the charities I can think of don't fall into that category. I'm trying to think what in practice makes these others unique.
A public
the lack of the actual membership of people.
A public benefit corporation is generally defined as a corporation to which you have no say on how the funds are spent, and the people that run that corporation are not the beneficiaries of your donation. In other words, any corporation that people donate to that's going to spend the money for something else. For example, a group that puts together a food bank for helping the hungry in Ethiopia. The participants in the thing do not benefit from the donations that are made because they go to a third identifiable group. Your mutual benefit corporation, on the other hand, specifically sets forth the benefit. The Automobile Association of America, the Chamber of Commerce, a labor union, they all have very specific goals for which you contribute their money with the expectation that you know what that money will be spent for. Unlike the public benefit corporation, which you just say, well, I want to help the needy in the Soviet Union. You give some money to somebody. You have little or no control over what happens to that money, how it's spent, whether it even gets spent for the alleged purpose for which it's collected.
Although, well, I'm thinking of Awake, and I sit on the board of Awake in Anchorage, which is, in my way of thinking, as you were describing it, would be mutual aid, because whatever's donated to them is given to someone else. So,
that's probably a mutual benefit corporation. Okay. As a practical matter, there will be instances when it's difficult or impossible to distinguish between the two types. Okay. As drafted, the statute takes that into consideration, because if there's an abuse because you're in the wrong section, the court has the ability to undo that abuse, so to speak.
Okay.
And so,
is there always a board in either case?
I'm sorry?
Is there always a board required?
Well, there may be a board, there may be a membership.
Okay.
The board may perpetuate itself. There may be a general membership as specific members. There may be just a group of people that have membership cards that only vote for limited purposes but don't really control how the funds are done and don't really control necessarily how the board operates or even what the composition of the board is. So what you're trying to do is cover all the bases. Again, obviously, you can't define every type of corporation. There's a third type of nonprofit corporation that is alive and well in the state of Alaska. That's the corporation that deals with grants from political subdivisions. And that's very difficult to try and categorize or pigeonhole that particular type of corporation. And it also gives rise to problems with jurisdictional disputes, because in theory, at least, when a government grant is given, there's some oversight attached to the giving of that grant. In practice, that's probably not true in 90% of the cases in Alaska, but at least in theory, that's the concept. So we've tried to provide the concept again of expressing a charitable trust on that corporation, regardless of what it calls itself, if the facts so require, so that, say, justice could be done under the circumstances.
Other questions?
Representative
Taylor's turn.
This third group you're mentioning, people who get grants from municipalities, is that what you said?
Yes.
What's an example of that, or trying to, and are they covered?
Well, probably probably the biggest area of grants and aid comes from the University of Alaska. And they give grants for you name it. If somebody's thought about it, the university's probably given a grant. To study the wildlife habits of the Arctic fox or whatever it happens to be. I mean, there's as many as you can put a name on, studying the electrical displays of the northern lights.
So you're saying that someone who receives these grants, you're talking about a case where they're a nonprofit entity of their own rather than individual?
They're a nonprofit, but they're a hybrid in the sense that they don't easily fall into the public benefit or mutual benefit corporation mold, because they don't collect money from the general public. They don't have a membership.
So this third category existed previously in the law.
Yeah, well, they're around.
But, I mean, there's no separate... I'm trying to get at, is there a separate provisions for them?
No. The general provisions of the bill would cover that kind of corporation to fill in any voids that existed in government oversight regulation.
So they're going to be treated as a public benefit or as a mutual benefit?
They're not going to be treated really as either one. They don't fit into either category.
So this does create a third category.
It doesn't create a recognizable category per se. What it does, it has general principles that apply to nonprofit corporations as appropriate. In other words, if you've got something that you can't categorize as public benefit or mutual benefit, then it is subsumed under the general principles for impression of charitable trust, reporting requirements, fiduciary obligation, as your other two types, your public benefit, mutual benefit, because it doesn't fit into those categories. And again, there's not so much concern there because, at least in theory, the political subdivision that's making the grant is supposed to be watching that particular hen house. I mean, if it's not, it's not.
So there's an area that, I don't know particularly much about how it's dealt with even in existing law, but I assume there probably isn't very much to it there. Just how charities make the decisions beyond just the general charitable trust concept of any standards we could impose or consider imposing on the amount of benefit they've got to pass forward versus the amount they receive it. The cases you hear of outside, and probably within Alaska as well, of someone who is using their funds for a particular benefit, but they take in, $1 million and they only give $10,000 to whatever the cause is, either through padded overhead or just through high fundraising costs, who knows. Is there anything in the old version or the new proposal that deals with that?
No. What you find in Senate Bill 205 are sections which deal with notification to the membership or the group of what it is that you're doing, including a breakdown in administrative expense, gross receipts, administrative expense, money spent for labor, a simple delineation of how you spent the money. This does not attempt to establish a formula for how you spend the money. And the reason it doesn't is because that would vary so much with each type of organization that I think it would be legislatively impossible to do that. It might be desirable, and I think it probably is, personally speaking, to have something like that, but it would be a nightmare to try and incorporate into a statute, unless you just wanted to take a very hard-line position and say, we insist that 40% go for the stated purpose. Then you're going to have to worry about how the court's going to determine what a stated purpose is when you have such generic language in any nonprofit code, by the nature of a nonprofit code, as to what the purposes are. For charitable purposes, for religious purposes, it's pretty hard to determine that, and the enforcement would be almost impossible unless you had a huge budget to pay. So no, in short, there's nothing in here that attempts to coerce the spending of funds in a responsible fashion. However, you do have the ability of aggrieved parties, whether they be creditors or members, to go to court and complain if there's been an abuse in the use of the funds. You also have the concept of the charitable trust, where a court can say, okay, we think that you're spending too much money on overhead. We're going to characterized this portion of the money as being held in trust for the specific purpose of the nonprofit corporation. But I think it would be a nightmare to try and impose limits on what was spent, because it will be different given the type of corporation that you've got.
The case we hear about sometimes, or I've had complaints about, are the ones where someone is doing phone solicitation. I assume these are groups that don't have a particular membership, so they fall into the public benefit. If someone opens up, sets up to do something like that, and they haven't formed anything more than two individuals doing it, they're soliciting funds, and there's no connection. I'm trying to think, I can understand with the mutual benefit group how the disclosure system works, because then there's a newsletter or some opportunity to explain what's used to find. These, I'm not sure how we have any effective disclosure. I mean, I know this isn't, you're not going to have the solution necessarily to this problem, but I'm trying to think through what we can do to try to get some disclosure into these kind of entities as well. Because we don't have standards there, and you know, we hear of cases where a large amount goes to, you know, not to the cause. I don't know what we can do to.
There are some limited things that you can do, Representative Finkelstein. For example, one of the big abuses that existed in Anchorage in the late 70s and early 80s had to do with health clubs that were created, sold a bunch of memberships, including a great many life memberships, and then sold, either dissolved the corporation, collapsed it, or sold it to somebody new. And when you came back with your life membership card, the new owner said, gee, you know, I didn't engage in that contract agreement with you. I have no obligation to meet this. And for a while, that was policed by the Department of Law, when we still had a section which dealt with consumer complaints. Since that's been done away with, we don't really have a mechanism for dealing with that. However, we have addressed such things in the bill. You can't merely create a nonprofit corporation, take a lot of money, and then sell it to somebody else or merge it in a new corporation and decline to meet any of the obligations that were stated. The example you give is one that doesn't really lend itself to law enforcement, because you're talking about people that are not willing to abide by the law. The telephone solicitation group are tenanted by people that will call in. They do not register with the Division of Corporation. They do not attempt to get a certificate of authority to operate if they're a foreign corporation. And they don't care what they're doing. And you're never going to get them to report. You're never going to catch them. The best you can do is to rely on the criminal code to try and catch these people and to impose sanctions. So if you're not willing to abide by the code, there's very little that you can do. If you're operating in this state, however, and you do something that causes your corporation to be involuntarily dissolved, then you are precluded as a matter of law from suing in court as a plaintiff to enforce any contracts or to collect any monies that you have. So that can be a fairly formidable sanction when you're talking about a corporation that declines to follow the dictates of the law. But for the maverick that wants to come in and do a telephone solicitation and say, I'm a nonprofit corporation collecting for the starving people in Magadan, you don't even know that they're there. They're in, they do their business, and then they're gone. And nothing that you could put in here would affect them, because they're not going to follow the code anyway.
For the record, Representative Bretman has joined us. Questions by other members of the committee? Representative Biden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was a good overview. We appreciate that. And the transition made by the religious organizations, the question I have is for basically only the committee chairs. I'm just trying to find window to touch base with my preachers and priests in my community to check up on, to see where they're at, to see if they're comfortable. And if necessary, some of their concerns, I'd like to take a look at them. Hopefully we have a week, maybe 2 weeks. I don't know. What is your schedule in moving this bill?
Take these that long. You got plenty of time.
Yeah.
But I think you'll find most of them pretty overwhelmed, too. You know, it's one of these things that they'll have to go and talk to whoever handles their taxes and affairs, I suppose, because not something most of us can really get on top of.
If I could add, I will say that
just trying to keep them out of jail.
We did notice up a public hearing, the commission, and invited, to the extent that we could, religious corporations to attend the public hearing, and nobody attended. Also, we made a good faith effort, and I believe we succeeded in meeting all of the objections of religious groups that were expressed in our 6.5 hours of teleconference in 1983 in terms of not imposing additional paperwork, unreasonable requirements, intruding in the area of freedom of religion, ease of transition to get out of one area and into another. And we believe that with the exception of the concept of imposition of a charitable trust, you will find nothing that's really new in 1041 except a very detailed explanation for the layperson is how you operate as a nonprofit religious corporation, so that everything's spelled out, and you don't have to guess as you do under the present Title 40 or Chapter 40.
So we'll hope that no one in either the organizations or their attorneys have had an original thought since 1983.
I'm sorry.
I'm being facetious.
I don't think we had more than one or two people from what I call plain vanilla flavored nonprofit corporations, secular corporations that testified at that public hearing. They were all religious corporations that we had no idea were in Chapter 20 at all. I mean, we were astounded to find 500 or so religious corporations in the secular nonprofit chapter. And it was only after we looked at the thing that we discovered that's why, because we've got a 1040 that disallows the vast majority of your Protestant religious organizations from incorporation. And we hadn't intended on doing anything with the religious corporation section and only did so that we could do something with the ANCC. We can't do anything with the ANCC until we move all these people out into a different section so that what we impose on the nonprofit corporations is not imposed on the religious corporations. Or the hands-off policy for religious corporations.
Do you remember when the notice public hearing was?
I'm sorry,
do you remember when that public hearing was that you noticed?
That would have been, I think, sometime. It may have been in either September of last year or March of last year. My inclination is to say it was in March of last year.
Okay.
We held our last meeting. September was under the new fiscal year. I think it was the last meeting we held under fiscal year 91. And nobody showed up. So.
Okay.
This stuff's pretty exciting.
It is.
I did have a question, and I don't mind.
Okay, the Department of Commerce gave us a position paper with some questions and concerns. Have you had an opportunity to review that?
Yes, I have, Madam Chair, and every one of the items contained in there has either been withdrawn or resolved.
Okay, and we do have someone from the department, Mr. Monaco, to testify today.
Right.
Representative Taylor?
Yeah, I just in general wanted to know, those existing nonprofits that are out there, they now need to, upon passage, will they need to refile? What do they need to do?
They will have until 1997 to bring their articles up to speed before the default provisions take effect, as far as the articles are concerned. We used the same concept with the for-profit code, and that was that there was a 5-year period to do your administrative things, after which time the default provisions of the code would apply. So there will be some minimal things that they have to do, but it's fairly simple. I mean, we've got two sections in the ANCC and the ARCC, and they just say, here are the mandatory requirements that the Department of Commerce requires for articles of incorporation, and here are a whole list of optional ones that you can apply if you want.
So we won't, assuming passage of this thing, it's not really going to hit the fan until about 97.
97 is correct.
I assume that the Department of Commerce, as they promulgated regs, pursuant to the bill, would probably, I don't know, just when you have a corporation, do you have to renew your paperwork every once in a while?
You have to file a biennial report.
Okay, so there is a way for Commerce to reach out and touch these people and put them on an alternating schedule. I suspect Commerce doesn't want them to all come in at once, too, so they probably alternate the...
Yeah, I let Mr. Monaco speak to that, but for the most part, Commerce doesn't really care as long as you put in the minimum required information. they don't have the ability or the resources to actually police or investigate. So they have to pretty much take at face value. If you list all the alien affiliates and you list all of the shareholders that own more than 5% interest in the corporation, this sort of thing. So those reports that come in every 2 years, the biennial reports, will continue to contain that information. However, in the as affects ANCC and ARCC corporations, there will be the addition of certain minimal financial information. Information that the corporation should have anyway, will not require going out and getting an audit, certified or otherwise, will not require the hiring of a CPA or an accountant. It's just, how much money did you take in last year? What did you spend on salaries? You know, what were the general sources of it? Donations, you know, so on and so forth.
Okay. I might suggest for the Benny Finkel's time that we do a joint letter from the two Labor and Commerce Committees to such people as Bishop Hurley, Reverend Credo, whomever, any other members would like to say that the bill is in front of us. While it may move on to judiciary on either side, would they please get their comments back by a date certain, and then we can share those. If we go ahead and move it out of Senate Labor and Commerce to Senate Judiciary, which is my intent, not today, but in the near future, and then we would notify as many people as we can think of to notify.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was your intent to limit it to just a couple of religious organizations?
I just said all of the people that we come up with.
Okay. In other words, as many as possible.
Plus, we can sit down with the phone books, but news travels pretty fast, too, from church to church to church. So.
Yeah, the newspaper.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Ask staff to pursue that. Other questions for Mr. Abbott? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for listening to a very boring topic.
Well, if the statute is as clear and easy for lay people to understand as the description is, then I think you've done a great job.
I can say without qualification that it's a vast improvement over existing law. Whether or not it will make people smile is something that remains to be seen. But thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Monagle.
Madam Chair, Joint Committee members, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm with the Department of Commerce. I'm the Corporation Section Supervisor. And in light of the facts that John just gave you, I'll jump right ahead to the fiscal notes and position paper. I'm sure the committee members have questions about these two items. I did have an opportunity to sit down 2 or 3 hours this morning with Mr. Abbott and go over some of our concerns, and like he mentioned, with a couple of amendments, and that he's willing to incorporate into the bill, and clarification of some of the language that we feel we can amend probably this fiscal note. It was drafted originally with the idea that under the way the bill was written, the department would have more of a regulatory role in the operation of the nonprofits. And I think going back and discussing with Mr. Abbott, we've come to the conclusion that a lot of these provisions are optional, discretionary, and not specifically mandatory. The existing statutes are very vague. They give the commissioner no authority to intervene. And there was some discussion a little bit earlier about some of the situations that arise. There was recently a nonprofit corporation formed for the purpose of giving supplies, food, medical, otherwise, to the Magadan area. And we were informed by a member of the public that he believed that the corporation was soliciting the funds and pocketing the change, and that nothing was ever transpiring. Now, under the existing statute, there was really nothing we could do to assist that person. Charitable solicitations in general are fall under fraud, abuses of fraud, and the Consumer Protection Division no longer exists within the Department of Law. Their staff is really unable to jump in and assist the public. So really we support the overall intent of the bill to give the commissioner some discretionary authority to do some investigatory work when those types of things arise, and whether the agency itself would complete that work, or whether it would refer that then to the Department of Law would depend on the case. At this time, I take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Monaghan. Any questions for the department? Okay. The two of you spoke this morning about specific amendments that might be made.
That's correct.
Can you get to us, and you can do it either way, what probably would be best, I guess, since this is now going through drafting, is get us the conceptual amendments, and then we'll take them to drafting, to ledge drafting. Thank you for your input. Our staff on that. Great. Okay. Excellent. No questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time and for your work on the bill. Does anyone else wish to testify on Senate Bill 205? Mr. Hutchins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not often that I get the opportunity to be the sole representative of the public at a public hearing, but couldn't let this opportunity to pass.
Can you state your name?
I'm David Hutchins. I manage two nonprofit corporations incorporated under the laws of Alaska, the existing nonprofit corporation section. One of them is the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association, which is tax exempt under 501c6, the same section that trade associations and chambers of commerce commonly are under. The other was organized a little over a year ago. It's the Eureka Educational Foundation, and our members of the state association went together to form this educational foundation. And it's also tax exempt, but under another section. I don't remember which one it is.
C3.
It's probably C3, but I'm not certain. At any rate, I was quite interested in the comments from Mr. Abbott about they'd used the requirements on C3 as the model for drafting the state statute, and the IRS regulations are quite different in some of the different categories. C3 is one of the more restrictive categories, and as I've gone through this bill, I don't find anything to complain about at all in regard to the association. But I have a question in regard to the foundation, and it may just be because I don't understand it, but on page 16, the restriction on accumulation of current assets, as an educational foundation, that corporation gets funds as an endowment. And only the income off of that is used for giving the scholarships and engaging in other educational activities. And as I read it, it would appear that this would prohibit the kind of operation that we have in the Educational Foundation because of the endowment nature of the organization. Perhaps I'm mistaken. Merely need to have it clarified for me.
I could please.
Mr. Abbott,
why
don't you come ahead?
N21-175 generally tracks the provisions of the Internal Revenue Code and the treatment that's afforded by the Internal Revenue Code for the accumulation of surplus capital. And you can lose your tax-exempt status for failure to comply with those provisions. This section was very carefully drafted to provide for absolute minimum identification of what your corporate charitable purpose is. And by that I mean that you have to identify generally what it is, and those funds can be accumulated for purposes of implementing whatever that purpose is. What this directs attention to is a situation where a corporation says, we're going to do charitable things and we're going to collect a lot of money, and it does proceed to collect a lot of money and then never spends it. That's all this does. So in terms of your particular group, that would allow you to accumulate funds not only for existing programs that you had going on, but to accumulate funds for the implementation of new programs that you anticipated in the future, so long as you very generally identified what those new programs were. If you just talk in terms of we're going to do some charitable things in the future, yes, that would then you would, your group would be affected by that. If you have any kind of minutes or board minutes or a meeting that says we're going to do a specific thing and you identify it, you're free to accumulate that. Again, you're going to have greater difficulty in convincing the Internal Revenue Service that you're meeting its requirements than the state, because the state really doesn't care, for that matter. There's a lot of provisions in here like this that try and give guidance to the incorporators of a nonprofit corporation that cannot afford to have legal counsel or CPAs on the staff or on contract to give them a lot of information. So this tries to just alert you to it, and it really doesn't, it doesn't intend to impose any kind of a condition on you. As far as the provisions that are incorporated in here, the article requirements that are mandatory, that generally reflects the things that are contained in the code, it is not dispositive. You're absolutely correct. There are other provisions of the Internal Revenue Code that are not included in here, and you may or may not want to put those in the articles of incorporation.
You know, it might be helpful if afterwards if you could talk to Mr. Hutchins a little bit, because it isn't clear from this exact section what you just explained. I think it's probably inherent somewhere else. This section seems to say what Mr. Hutchins said, and it probably just ties into some other sections or something.
The language that I'm looking at is in line 16, and it talks about a reasonable reserve for planning. Mm-hmm. Line 16 talks about a reason. That's the phrase that gives you the escape, because that can include just about anything. What it does, it infers that there is something to plan for.
What it implies, though, it seems to discount or possibly eliminate the idea of trusts or reserve funds where you aren't using the principal, you're using the income off of it. I wouldn't read it just in trying to interpret this. If you're accumulating assets in excess of your liabilities, if you're saving up to try to get $1 million so you can produce grants from that, and I wouldn't consider that to be a reasonable reserve for planning. I'd consider that to be trying to build a large principal to, you know, do something in the future.
The commission doesn't have any problems with the committee making changes to this.
No, that's what I'm trying to get at.
With the understanding that if you do, you may do it work a disservice on the person that's uninitiated, because if the state is not going to jump in here and take some action on the basis of Section 175. It's going to be the Internal Revenue Service. They're going to swoop in. They're going to terminate tax exempt status for a corporation. So we don't care. I mean, we put this in to try and assist the uninitiated. Now, if you feel that there should be a language change in here or the narrative...
Well, I don't know what the answer is, and I was just trying to make sure you understood Mr. Hutchins' concern. Because we've got a balance, we want to allow people to build reserves if they've determined it's in the interest, you know, of their foundation or other entity to do it, and that's, you know, oftentimes approached by foundations. But at the same time, that does allow for people accumulating money, not expending it, and, you know, leaving the country. So... I don't know the answer. I think we'll just have to, you know, mark that as something to look at.
What we've tried to do is balance between the need to prescribe the activity of collecting funds without ever doing anything with them, and the need to collect funds without immediately being under pressure to spend them. In other words, we're not trying to coerce spending. By the same token, we're not going to encourage somebody to just collect funds and never do anything with it either. So some place in the middle, and that was the intent of the Code Commission, was to try and draft language which would accommodate that need.
Perhaps under a foundation that had some sort of an endowment situation where the corpus of the endowment would remain, could remain sitting, but the interest would be linked to it.
You have to read this in that perspective, and that is that if there's a specific endowment to you know, save the Arctic fox from extinction, that doesn't the fact that you've got that endowment doesn't necessarily mean that you've accumulated excess funds, because there is a specified purpose. Again, what this is trying to address is a situation where somebody collects money and then never does anything with it. Just puts it in the bank and has to draw interest. The people that contribute have a reasonable expectation that the money that they contribute for these purposes will be used for some charitable purpose, either specific or general.
And so is it, there have been some articles lately in some of the national publications about some of the major nonprofits or charitable organizations, I guess, around the country, United Way being one, Red Cross, many others. And I've seen a listing where each organization was given a score, if you will, by their overhead costs versus what actually got out to the people. The way is this is written, would there be a cause of action by a person who had donated money to a nonprofit that then perhaps ended up in the lower half or something like that, where there was a question about whether or not their money was being misspent, or is it just kind of...
This addresses unreasonable accumulation of funds. Okay. It does not address the way the funds are allocated or spent. It just tries to address a situation where whoever's operating the fund doesn't want to spend the money. And again, the donor's reasonable expectation is that the money will be spent for the solicited purpose. Okay. So that will have nothing, no bearing at all on the issue of how the money is spent.
But it seems that maybe we could deal with this issue, or maybe it's already dealt with in the area where we're talking about allowed expenditures. Somewhere we're talking about what's proper and what isn't. And that probably is the area to make sure that endowments are a proper expenditure. So you actually have to expend the money, you put it into some sort of category.
This bill doesn't tell you how to spend money.
No, there's the standard that we talked about earlier of the charitable trust concept. Somewhere, if you're defining that, somewhere you're drawing the line between vacations in Hawaii and, and that's probably, I'm going to say, it's probably the area we want to delineate this a little further. That's probably the area to put it in so that it's clear that that's an expenditure of money. When you're going, you're establishing an endowment, something like that. I don't know. I'm just trying to get to this question still of how do we make this clear. So, because on the face of it there, it's a bit of a drafting problem.
Representative Burton? Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a timeline in this? Your questions have answered most of my questions, but is there a timeline on the expenditure of funds or the way they do it? A reason, in other words, was there a reasonable length of time, if there's a reasonable reserve for planning purposes?
The bill does not attempt to impose any time restrictions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really define, other than use of the word reasonable, which is what a court would do. A court would look at the circumstances and say, I think it's reasonable that you've accumulated X number of dollars and you ought to be able to accumulate that without the excess, without losing your tax-exempt status. Mm-hmm. That would be done in tax court or federal district court, because the state would probably never challenge this. If a private person were to challenge this, probably a court would look at it and say, we don't think it's reasonable to accumulate $2 million and not have any stated purpose for spending it. I think anything short of that, a court would say, that's a matter for you folks in the nonprofit corporation to work out. We can't arbitrate all those decisions on how you spend the money. It would, in my opinion, it would have to be a fairly egregious situation where a court would step in and say, we feel that you're not doing what the statute requires.
Mr. Abbott, are you still going to be in town tomorrow?
I can be if I can be of assistance.
What I was thinking was perhaps you and whoever did the drafting, and I don't know who did it, but the gentleman above people did the drafting, and you could sit down with staff in both committees and Mr. Hutchins to talk through that and see if we can clarify for both our understanding but also for his question. And any others that might come up.
I'd be pleased
to
do that. And also,
since we need to do the amendments anyway, it would probably be better if you face to face with the drafter.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. I'd be pleased to stay here, and we can go over the changes that we want to make that we've agreed with the Division of Corporations on.
Okay, that would be.
Thank you.
Okay, and obviously, Commerce is welcome to be part of that process. Okay, anything else to, anyone else have any questions? Anything else to come before the joint committees? If not, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.